I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Marketing Trends and the Leeds Art Week.
For years, college athletes have racked up Twitter and Instagram followers due to their on-the-field fame. But despite these large followings, a quarterback known for slinging touchdowns was prohibited from slinging endorsements, thanks to a system that prohibited athletes from profiting off their image or performance. But in the summer of 2021, that changed. And with college athletes now able to profit off their name, image, and likeness, it's left companies such as Captivate, an influencer marketing platform, ready to hit the ground running with a new pool of talent.
Scale for creators or athletes within specific verticals, it's pretty tough, right? Because it's hard to snap your fingers and get 100 college athletes activated in minutes. Platforms like Captivate have made it easier to do that in the digital creator space with creators that have been around for a while, so you can go through specific verticals. But I feel like college athletes, it's a green field right now.
Krishna Subramanian is the co-founder of Captivate. And on this episode of Marketing Trends, Krishna goes deep in the weeds of influencer marketing and how these new opportunities with college athletes can help brands. Plus, Krishna provides some do's and don'ts for brands that are looking to partner with influencers. Enjoy this episode. This message is brought to you by Salesforce. Hey marketers, today's B2B buyers are more complex than ever, and every buying committee has different needs and goals. Salesforce can help. We'll show you how to put each and every customer at the center of your B2B marketing strategy, and you'll learn how top brands like Lyft approach account-based marketing. Salesforce, market to every account, speak to every buyer. Find free B2B marketing and ABM resources at sfdc.co/every-buyer.
Welcome to Marketing Trends. I'm Ian Faison, host of Marketing Trends, and today we are joined by a special guest. Krishna, how are you?
I'm doing amazing. Happy Friday.
Yeah, happy Friday indeed. Super excited to have you on the show, talking about Captivate and all the cool stuff that you all are doing. And your background, not necessarily as a pure marketer, but a hybrid, a serial entrepreneur and a marketer. How'd you get started in marketing in the first place?
Sure. So I went to undergrad at UC Davis. I got a bachelor's in medical microbiology, was on my way to medical school, and decided to take a year off. I was just getting burnt out. Moved out to New York. I was doing research at the New York Academy of Medicine during the day. I was staying in my uncle and aunt's basement in Queens. And so in the evening and night, I'd come home and I was building websites and apps and just working on different projects to make money to move out into Manhattan. One thing led to another and ended up meeting some folks that were in the advertising space, moved back to the Bay Area and helped start up Blue Lithium, which was an online ad network.
So you co-founded Captivate. Tell us a little bit about the company.
Sure. Yeah. So Captivate is an influencer marketing platform. You know, essentially how we started about 5 years ago, just really got interested in how millennials were, you know, changing the way they consume content, spending a lot less time in front of the TV and more time in front of platforms like Instagram, Snap, YouTube, et cetera. And essentially, as they started changing the way they consume content, a lot of brands changed the way they engage with millennials, because they realize the millennial is not going to click on a banner ad and buy something, but they're highly influenced by these digital celebrities. So my background started off originally at Blue Lithium, online ad network that was acquired by Yahoo, then MobClicks, which was a mobile ad exchange that was acquired by Velti. But it's always around analytics and data. So when we got into the social space about 6 years ago, the idea was, well, how can we help brands identify their Oprah effects? How can we predict virality and measure the velocity of content being shared? Instagram specifically, and you know, sort of just double down on Instagram. And that was prior to Instagram even having an API for marketers to tap into. Very quickly, a lot of the brands that were using our platform started to reach out and ask us to help them activate influencers. And that's when we built out our end-to-end platform that really helps brands identify influencers, activate them, and then measure all the attribution from that content.
I love influencer marketing. It's one of my favorites. We've talked about it a bunch on the show. So I'm excited to dive super deep into that. Like, where are we at? What inning are we at in influencer marketing?
I think we're you know, we're still in the early days of influencer marketing. And I think over the last 18 months, you know, through COVID and through the pandemic, I think it's been really exciting to see brands really lean into influencers and creators. You know, they leaned into them to tell those authentic stories of their brands. Consumers were looking to people that they trust, whether they're their friends or, you know, creators that they have an emotional connection to. And those creators became really important storytellers for the brand. You know, we started to see the growth that we've seen over the last 18 months is unlike anything that we've seen in the past. And it feels like the early days of mobile, where everyone, you know, everyone wants to work with creators and influencers, you know, and I'd say the reason why I think it's still very much the early days is because influencer marketing today is still predominantly really focused on branding and awareness. And I think there's a lot of opportunity to go further down the funnel as the market gets more mature.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's so brand level, but with so many different platforms and so many different apps that people are using, and those apps, generally speaking, want to make money the way that they want to make money, not the way that the people on the platform do. I mean, classic example is, you know, YouTube creators over the years that, you know, if you go talk to 10 YouTube creators, I don't think that they love YouTube very much, despite, you know, all of the things that have happened to them on YouTube. So there seems to be some amount that's at odds with the platform and the platform wanting you to use them versus, you know, the actual creator and how they can monetize in other ways. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think it is fair. I think, you know, creators care about two things. They care about growing their audience and making money. And then when you look at the making money part, there's lots of different ways for them to make money. Some platforms make it really easy to turn on ads right, you know, from day one, you know, and I think other platforms make it a lot harder to get sponsored content, and you have to go out and find your own deals. You know, some of them have tipping. So I think there's lots of different ways. And I think each platform is sort of leaned into slightly different strategies. I think YouTube being, you know, probably the first place that creators were born, right? It was, you weren't an influencer or creator, you were a YouTuber. And I think they have created one of the, you know, the best ecosystems for creators. Being able to turn on Google Ads right off the bat, I think is pretty exciting. But, you know, I think it is harder to get a lot of that branded content and custom content into longer form YouTube videos.
Yeah. And I just use that as kind of like this cautionary tale, where you have one change to the algorithm, one change to the platform, one change to something. You know, we saw this with companies with like Facebook pages and stuff like that. Companies spending millions and millions of dollars trying to build out their Facebook page. And then, you know, not seeing any of the organic kind of growth that they saw at the beginning because of, you know, Facebook wanting to monetize them, reaching their own audience, stuff like that. And the reason why I say all that, to set the stage for, it seems like a solution like yours is really necessary for companies to be able to tap into creator networks, to tap into influencers, to do things in a more, you know, predictable, programmatic way than kind of the old way, which is just kind of, hey, I'm going to set up a bunch of partnerships and have a big partnerships team that does that, or maybe small partnerships team that does that, and do a lot of stuff that's driving brand awareness.
Yeah. And I think one of the challenges is anytime you're building your brand, or, you know, whether you're a brand or you're a creator and you're building your audience on a specific social platform, you don't own that audience. Right? The platform does. And I think that's, some of it's an opportunity and some of it's also a challenge for a brand, right? So, you know, I think if you go back 5 years ago, it's like, what is the value of a Facebook like? Like, does it really matter? And, you know, people are going out and buying likes. But I think as you start to think about it and think about just growing audiences, I think you start to look at what can you do beyond just that high level awareness? How can you create authentic relationships with creators over a longer period of time so that you start to drive real impact towards your brand?
Okay. So what are some examples of ways that companies are doing this now? What are the best and brightest here doing to leverage these type of strategies? And obviously, you know, using Captivate as part of that.
I think generally from an influencer marketing standpoint, you know, brands are always looking to, you know, for that long-term relationship and marriage with a creator. Neither side wants a one-night stand. And so I think when you think about it that way, it's how do you find influencers and creators that are truly going to resonate with your brand? The way a lot of brands will tap into to captivate is sort of looking at it in three parts. One is just looking at the creators and the creator audiences. What type of audience demo data does a creator have? How does that overlap with the same, you know, personality archetype, brand affinity that I might have as a brand? The location of the creators, the age, gender, all of those metrics are sort of the first step of identifying, you know, if an influencer is going to make sense to actually partner with. I think as you go through that step of just going through these in-depth creator profiles, you start to look at all the data and then start to activate these creators. I think thinking about activation strategy is you can think about it in two ways. One is, you know, in phase one, let's say you activate 25 creators, right? And you go out there and you put together a specific creative concept or strategy for all of them. And you see how each individual creator performs on that first campaign. And, you know, some might have an audience that really resonates with your brand. Some, you know, the creator that you thought might perform the best might be the worst and vice versa. But what that allows you to do is do a quick test and then start to narrow that down where you can go ahead and then take the next, you know, the next activation and narrow it down to, let's say, the five best performing creators and start turning them on an ongoing basis. So that perhaps they're posting monthly and just creating this really strong partnership with your brand. The things that we see performing really well are more of those always on types of campaigns where the creators are embedding that brand into their day-to-day life on an ongoing basis. Whether you're getting paid on a performance basis, you know, driving downloads to a game or just for certain amounts of awareness over the course of a month, it still creates that authenticity and your followers then start to believe that a lot more and start to, you know, follow along.
Yeah. One of the studies that I read, this is like years ago, that Tim Ferriss polled his audience where it was something like 98% of his listeners didn't care about having ads or something like that. And 80% of his listeners actually enjoyed his ads because they taught them about products and services that like Tim uses or is a fan of. And I'm like, man, that's what you want to hear as a marketer, right? You're like, let's activate that guy. And obviously that's why the ad units on his show were like crazy expensive. But if you look at some of the best, and taking podcasts as an example, some of the best podcasts that have massive followings, the marketing that they're doing is so like long-term and deep and embedded, in addition to obviously the thing that they're doing that's just, you know, the host read ads, but they're doing partnerships that last for years. And like, that's a great spot to be if you're that type of a company.
Yeah, 100%. There's a fitness creator that I follow on Instagram, Devin Levesque. You know, he partners with probably about 10 different brands, but you see those brands every day. It's like Gymshark, Core Water, Whoop, you know, whatever it might be. And you know, if I look at that and I'm like, you know, his intensity is at another level and I feel like I need to be wearing these shoes or wearing these pair of shorts, or, you know, I need the Whoop to be able to compete. It doesn't feel like he's selling anything. It feels like that's the secret sauce that he uses to stay in shape or whatever it might be. And I think that's what drives a lot of the people to just go out there and follow him, right? They want to see what it is. They want to know, even if he's not out there saying, buy this, buy this.
You know, it's funny when we, one of our shows that I hosted for a long time, we would get a bunch of stuff sent to us from, you know, all sorts of different folks that, you know, wanted us to try different products and things like that. And it's so funny as like the creator, you're trying all these different products and it's really obviously fortunate and cool, but you really start to have an affinity to certain companies. You know, take for example, we did a partnership with Fully Desks a number of years ago on a different podcast. I have two Fully Desks in my house now. Like I bought one for my wife. They're like amazing. Every single person is like, oh, what desk do you have? But it's like those sort of things where it's like, it actually is like my favorite desk, right? And it all started because we did an ongoing promotion with them that turned into, you know, them outfitting our office and doing all this stuff. And like, it was so impactful for us as a business, but also impactful for them in driving results. And like, if you can be that marketing team that is doing that for creators, like they will go to bat for you forever.
Because not only are they going to keep using your product and getting their creator network to use your product or believe in it, they'll also defend you, right? And that's the strongest thing you need, right? It's not even the creator defending the brand, but the creator's following defending the brand, right? And I think that's how loyal fans are and followers are. And that's like the ultimate, you know, sort of win for a brand when people within the comments are defending the brand or talking about how much they love it.
That's a great point. Are you measuring that? Is that a metric? Brand defense? Is that a Captivate metric?
Well, we measure two things around that. So we look at comments and we look at brand lift and we look at purchase intent. And so the idea is before a creator posts about a specific brand, how is that audience of that creator actually talking about the brand, and how is it changing once the creator starts endorsing a specific brand? Is it changing in a positive way or a negative way? What is that percentage lift? And then two, it's looking at more of those bottom of the funnel metrics. Are you driving someone into a store? Are people talking about purchasing that product? And so there's definitely a lot of those metrics. I think that's where the market is going. That's where the space is going. And that's what brands really care about.
Yeah, they do. And you kind of gave us a little overview there, but I think brand lift and purchase intent being new types of metrics back in the day, not even back in the day, we still use impressions as our primary metric. We use obviously all of our CPA type, conversion metrics, but things like affinity have been so tough to track over time. Like how is that changing? How are these metrics changing?
Yeah. I mean, I think the metrics, first off, right. It's, 5 years ago, people really cared about just likes, right? How many likes did we get on our sponsored post? And now it's like, so what, right? Great. We got all these likes. What did it do for us? And, where you're starting to see that even more is on TikTok, right? You do these hashtag challenges and you're getting billions of views. Nowhere else on any other platform can you get billions of views on a piece of content, right? Content just doesn't go as viral as it does on TikTok anywhere else. But what does that mean, right? If you're a CPG brand, is everyone going out and running and buying your product? Or are those views all coming from US subscribers, right? Or a US audience? I think as you start to look at, a deeper set of metrics, it's in two ways, right? You can look at brands that are just looking for, let's say awareness. Some of the things they really care about are going to be, let's say, sentiment of the comments, right? Are people that are seeing this creator's content, are they happy about it? Are they excited about the brand versus just being excited about the creator, right? So is it, as opposed to, I love Ian, is it like, I love the Nike shoes that Ian's wearing, right? For example. And then starting to, take sentiment into brand lift and just seeing, how much impact is that having? How much impact is it driving to the bottom line? Are people actually going to go out and purchase this? I think it becomes a lot easier as you start to look at more direct response sorts of metrics, right? So if you're looking at specific sales and conversions or installs or signups, because those are hard metrics you could track back to specific creators and specific URLs. And so the whole attribution funnel is very easy to look at. So that's why you're seeing a lot of brands that are built on top of Shopify, for example, that they heavily lean into creators because they can map that entire thing from end to end.
I mean, back in the day, using television, newspaper, yellow pages, like all these things, right? That was kind of just hope and pray, right? Hey, this is the circulation, this is the reach, this is all that stuff. And all that stuff worked, right? We didn't know how well it was working. We didn't know that sort of stuff. But now, when you're talking about these TikTok piece, like part of advertising is about waste. It's about how much money are we going to spend to reach, the maximum amount of people that are, going to be able to take action. But knowing that if you don't cast a wide enough net, if you don't spend enough money, you're not going to maximize your potential, catch, for lack of a better word. So how do you think about waste with regards to influencer marketing?
It's a great question. And I don't think enough brands think about it that way, right? Because a lot of times brands are looking at a specific audience and saying, we need to hit these 10 demos across the entire US. What percentage of this person's audience sits in those 10 demos? And you're very rarely going to get a high number in specific zip codes or specific DMAs, because just by the nature of these creators, they're, you know, fairly global. They'll have an international presence as well as, US. One of the biggest pieces I think that's really important is looking at international versus US, right? And if you are a US focused brand, at least measuring it at that level, knowing that there's a large enough percentage of that audience that sits in that specific country, you're hitting the right, let's say, gender and age. I think those are other sort of high level metrics you can look at. Once you sort of go beyond that, right, part of what you need to do is make sure the content is actually going to resonate with the audience that you're looking to hit. Just because, you know, let's say 70% of someone's audience is male and in New York, doesn't mean that's going to be the most engaged audience, right? You need to make sure the content is also hitting that. And the social platforms, when you're posting native influencer content, they actually don't tell you what percentage of, you know, your likes and comments came from your target demo, right? A lot of it is based on estimated metrics, outside of the social platforms themselves.
You know, you have folks like Dr. Pepper and Amazon and Honda and all sorts of cool companies that are selling a variety of different types of products, and specifically trying to pair those with their kind of influencer archetypes or things like that. How much does like the type of influencer matter, you know, to these different types of companies?
It's actually really important. I think it's really important when you're looking at the brands that are driving branding and awareness, right? Because they've got specific brand and style guidelines that they're looking to hit. And that's what they care about, right? Like they are coming at it almost from a creative agency standpoint, saying, here's what our brand needs to look like. Here's who we want to represent it. And so we want to understand who these creators are, what they think, what they believe in, and just almost predict how well these creators are going to perform in the future or what they're going to react to in the future. That's, you know, from a branding and awareness standpoint. I think when you go to DR advertisers, they actually don't care as much, right? They just care about, are these creators driving sales? Great, they are. Let's pay them more, right? And let's keep going down that route. So I think you start out at that point. And then I think something else that you take into account is how much creative control does a brand really want, right? So if a brand wants a significant amount of creative control, don't go partner with the top creators or the top, you know, digital creators. Partner with a tier two or tier three creator who will be more open to allowing you to manage that end-to-end process and drive the creative strategy. If you're partnering with a tier one digital creator, the whole reason you're partnering with them is because they produce amazing content and they know how, you know, and that's why you're going to them, right? They know what sort of resonates with their audience. And I think that's one of the biggest mistakes brands will make is, you know, partnering with a tier one creator and then telling that creator exactly how they want them to produce content, what it needs to look like, what they need to say. And it just takes the entire authenticity away. And then, you know, everyone wonders why that content didn't perform well.
Yeah, that's an absolutely fascinating kind of insight. And it's so obvious the way that you said it, but I hadn't really thought about that you have certain like large scale brands that are almost more concerned about their image than the results of the campaign. And then you have certain people who are more concerned about the results of the campaign than like, who is even peddling. I mean, it's so fascinating because it speaks to like this totally new type of ad inventory that is so dynamic. Dynamic is already a word in the ecosystem, but it's something so different. Like influencer marketing is just so ridiculously complex. I agree that it's like the early days on this stuff, but it's so much more difficult to figure out from a company perspective than any other type of marketing like ever in history, because there's just so much more there's so many more things that can happen. You're like you said, you need to predict whether or not there's a probability that your influencer gets canceled, you know, in the next 6 months, right? If you're the type of brand that cares about that. Or if you're not, maybe you want that to happen so that their, you know, catalog gets more exposure or something. I mean, it's just so, it's so personality driven and complex that it adds a level for marketers that I'd imagine is obviously why they choose a platform like yours to support, but that it's just very difficult to wade through.
Oh, it's extremely tough, right? And I think it's because you're partnering with creators for the exact reason that you're worried about partnering with them as well, right? So you want their creativity and excitement, you know, you want the potential to go quote unquote viral, but because of all of those things, you also don't know, you know, there's a lot of unpredictability. How is their audience going to react, right? You mentioned canceling. Canceling's almost become cool in some aspects, right? Or people are just going out and constantly trying to cancel a specific creator. You know, you've got that, right? Where creators, you know, the fans that follow these creators will go out and just find reasons to hate them, message the brand and say, oh, did you know that this creator's brother's wife's mom said something racist on Twitter? Here's a screenshot of it. I can't believe you partnered with this person. And then run it up the chain to the CMO of a brand. The CMO of a brand will come to you and say, how could you not know this? How did you not look at this? And like, how could this possibly happen? Right. You know, things like that happen, you know, every so often. Or, you know, I think a couple of years ago, there's a YouTuber, you know, married and she has a few kids. She adopted a kid, but during the course of a partnership with a few brands, she gave one kid up. The kid that she adopted decided she couldn't take care of the kid anymore and gave it up. She got so much negative press for it. And then all the brands that she was working with started to show up in the same articles saying, you know, this creator partners with X, Y, and Z. Then those brands get really upset saying, how did you not know this is going to happen? And so that unpredictability is, you know, it's something that you can only predict, you know, to a certain extent. And, you know, I think a lot of these creators understand, right, their largest revenue stream is coming from branded content. And so they typically are making sure their brand safe themselves. But there's always that 1% chance that something crazy could happen and you just have to be able to react to it in the right way.
That's a horrible situation. That's really terrible. My gosh. Yeah. Well, and it's like, it speaks to, I mean, I think these are people's lives, right? Like they're not professional media people, for lack of a better word. They're not, you know, necessarily trained in any of this. This is literally their lives, you know, on display. And it's pretty easy for, you know, multitudes of people to jump on, you know, the decision-making of other people. And it's crazy that it even like comes back to the marketing teams that are buying those ads. But it is the state of where we are today, for better or for worse. And there's a lot of companies that, you know, that don't want to deal with that. You know, the other side of this is there's a lot of companies that feel very, you know, uncool, that feel very far from creative, that can't possibly do the things that, you know, they want to do with their brand voice or things like that. And they look at these influencers as a way to not just extend reach. It's not just like ads to them. They want that brand affinity with the creator. Can you talk about like why affinity is something that like matters or does it matter? Or is this something, you know, we talked about a little bit with people getting defended in the comments, but it's something that like, again, this is, you know, maybe you'd have that with certain advertising on different TV shows in the past, but it's not something that necessarily you could do at scale.
Yeah, I think brand affinity is really important. And I think it comes into one is, you know, does the brand share common values with the creator? And I can't tell you over the last 18 months, that's become one of the most important things when a creator is saying, well, what are the brand's values? You know, are they the same values that I have? You know, how do they look at diversity and inclusion? And, you know, so it's not just a brand picking a creator, it's also a creator picking a brand. And I think these shared values really help build a relationship, you know, which tends to keep people more loyal together, right? Whether it's the creator realizing, you know, this is a brand that I actually believe in and I can associate myself with, you know, and it's a brand that I could love and get to know, versus just saying, cool, send me the product, let me post about it, and, you know, let's move on. And that's the worst thing that a brand could really do, or a creator could do, is just doing a series of these one-off posts that are, that just end up failing. And then it just puts a bad taste in everyone's mouth in the chain, right? Because the brand looks at influencer marketing and says, oh, well, you know, that didn't work out so well. The creator's like, ah, I just got, you know, one-off post. It wasn't great. And then the creator's audience is like, and this creator just keeps posting about random brands that I never see again.
Let's talk about name, image, and likeness. Can you share what this is, and if for our listeners who don't know?
Sure. So, you know, I think one of the super exciting things is, you know, college athletics have really struggled to figure out how to implement a fair and balanced set of rules for student athletes to monetize their name, image, and likeness. The question is just how much money could that generate, and should college athletes be allowed to make, you know, make profit off of that? I mean, that's essentially what it is. And I think when we look at a lot of the recent sort of laws that have been passed, it's been super exciting because, you know, starting July 1st, you know, college sports and athletes will allow their athletes to receive, you know, compensation and be paid while they're competing for their schools. And, you know, that's something that was never done before.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, and I think they just kind of are in the middle of this like landmark case that's having to do with all of the college sports stuff. You know, from a human rights perspective, it's people should be able to monetize themselves because that's America and capitalism. But from the marketing standpoint, it really is an exciting development that these young athletes that are, you know, on the national stage for sure, world stage in a lot of cases, can figure out how to make a living, have a lasting impact in their life from this sort of thing is like so cool. I mean, you can just, the possibilities are endless. Do you see this as any difference from like other types of influencers? I mean, I know it's like a subsect of that, but is there anything that, like, you know, companies should be looking at as they look to partner with these athletes, you know, starting here this year?
Yeah. I mean, I think you start to look at these college athletes the same way you look at creators, and you use all the same metrics in terms of just understanding what, you know, what their audience looks like and what they stand for and what they're getting behind. I think it's also realizing that this is super early in their creative careers as well, right? So, you know, just being a freshman or sophomore in college, you're literally starting your life on social. You're going to start a lot earlier. Right? There's so many pro athletes that have one post on Instagram when they're on NFL draft day. Now it's going to completely change, because the minute they, you know, they're in high school, they're going to realize, hey, I have to be on social because this is a way for me to make money, even if I don't make it into professional leagues. And the other thing that's kind of exciting about it is maybe there's less pressure to turn pro right off the bat, right? And maybe it's, if you're making money throughout your college career, perhaps you finish it up and you stay for 4 years. But I think it's, you know, from a brand perspective, it's the same thing, just realizing that, you know, it's even earlier than just influencer marketing and digital creators. It's college athletes that are still learning about everything, understanding that, you know, college athletes, just like any other college student, you know, there might be ups and downs that happen, and you just have to be ready to react if something does happen.
How much do you think of this is a access to inventory, an ease to buy situation? Because, like, let's just take Gatorade, for example. If Gatorade wanted to buy, they wanted to be a sponsor for the top, basically every five-star athlete, let's just say, or maybe like every five-star quarterback or something like that, that's a rising freshman in college football. And they could do that, like, you know, snap their fingers, and they wanted to sponsor every fantasy football podcast and, you know, a bunch of the like meme accounts that are, you know, focused on college football quarterbacks or something like that. If you could do that with the snap of your fingers in a really easy way, it seems like that would happen a lot more. Is that where we're headed, or where are we headed?
Yeah, I think you bring up a great point. Like scale for creators or athletes within specific verticals, it's pretty tough, right? Because it's hard to snap your fingers and get, you know, 100 college athletes activated in minutes, right? Platforms like Captivate have made it easier to do that in the digital creator space, you know, with creators that have been around for a while. So you can go through specific verticals. But I feel like college athletes, it's a green field right now. And I think there's so much opportunity, you know, whether it's a Gatorade or, you know, shoe brand, whatever it might be, you could go out and sponsor entire college teams, right? As opposed to just the, you know, just certain players. And I think that could get you scale pretty quickly as well.
You could go sponsor every single athlete at Michigan and you don't need to actually ever talk to Michigan.
Like, exactly.
That 100%, is freaking great. That's really cool, man. I'm so excited for the player empowerment that's going to come with this. This is just like, it's so freaking awesome. So continue that. I mean, it seems like there's going to be a tipping point here where it's like, this stuff happens. I know you can't see into the future, but what is preventing more companies from using services like yours? What is preventing this kind of like next wave from happening?
So I think about it in two ways, right? I think brands are either going to, let's say, a creative agency and asking a creative agency to put together a campaign, think about the strategy and what the creative concept should look like and sort of executing it that way. I think there's lots of brands and ad agencies that come to Captivate and say they can work with us in two ways. And I think that's actually unique on its own. Is you might have your own internal team, your brand team that actually knows exactly what they want to do. They just want a platform and software to make it easy to bring scale to finding influencers, activating them, and then measuring it. And they just want to do it all in-house. You can do that self-serve from our platform. But the benefit of working with Captivate is, let's say your budgets outgrow your marketing team and you need to lean on another team to help execute on campaigns. You know, our team has a services, Captivate has a services team that just becomes an extension of your marketing arm. So we'll go out and we'll execute on behalf of you as well. That's the benefit for brands and agencies when they're working with Captivate. I think as long as a brand understands social, then, you know, they understand where and how to use influencers. And I think it's just what stage of that life cycle are they in? Are they still doing tests and just trying to figure out what is influencer marketing? You know, in those cases, they might be reaching out to influencers directly or reaching out to talent agencies, worried less about data and just more about, you know, the content that's coming out of it. But if you are a brand that's really looking to run campaigns on an always-on basis, you're looking for data-driven decision-making processes, then you really need a platform like Captivate.
What about LinkedIn? Where does this fit? You know, we have a lot of B2B listeners. B2B is very tricky. What do you think about influencer with regards to LinkedIn? Or just like influencers, B2B influencers in general?
So I think B2B influencers are, it's a growing space, right? Whether it's, you know, we've got a medical devices company that is recently launched a campaign and they've been partnering with physicians across the country. These physicians have a much smaller audience, specifically tied to, let's say, Twitter or LinkedIn. And so, you know, 5,000 followers on Twitter for a data scientist or a physician is highly valuable because that their audience is probably primarily, you know, other physicians. And so it's a growing space, but it's super effective. I think there's lots of opportunity, especially on LinkedIn, just given the virality of content on there as well.
Yeah, I think it's super underserved. I like to say that, you know, if you have a podcast that reaches 50 people in the world, everybody might think it's useless unless those are 50 Fortune 500 CEOs, and then you have the most valuable podcast in the world. And I think that that's, you know, it's one of those things where so much of marketing, you know, of the marketing world thinks in big numbers and massive campaigns and big impressions when you're thinking about B2B and in, or B2C. But when you're thinking B2B, you're talking in literally like these seven people that work at this company are the people that I want to get in front of this month? How do I get in front of these seven people over and over and over and over and over again? And it just changes. It changes the math. It changes the strategy. And I think influencer is something. I mean, I talk to B2B companies all day. I mean, I don't know. I essentially talk to none that use influencer.
Yeah, I think it's going to continue to be like a growing segment of influencer marketing. And I think part of that is going to be the platforms themselves embracing that audience. You know, I'd say TikTok is pretty interesting because you see so many physicians and dermatologists and, you know, creating content. You know, they're creating content to generate awareness. But I think platforms like Twitter and LinkedIn are great for, you know, that the B2B audience.
So any thoughts on Clubhouse and Twitter Spaces and some of these, you know, social audio or whatever we want to call this new kind of category?
Yeah. So, you know, when Clubhouse first launched, I was probably spending a few hours on it every day. Of course, there was nothing else to do. You know, you couldn't leave your house. So it was easy to sit on there and, you know, grow an audience. And, you know, I think there's always that first mover advantage of growing your audience on a platform that just launches. And so there's a lot of excitement there. I also thought it was really refreshing to be able to have intelligent conversations with people on a social platform versus creating video content on TikTok, right? It's the complete opposite. And, you know, I think from that perspective, it was great. You know, I've definitely met a lot of new people within the industry itself. And so, you know, I'm definitely excited to see where it goes and how it goes. I think when you think about the B2B audience, that's a perfect place where it's, how do you create that B2B audience on Clubhouse, right? Because unless if you're just hosting a room and you're a CMO, are you looking to just talk to a bunch of creators that are looking to be influencers and give them advice? Maybe once, maybe twice, but otherwise your value is probably better served in other areas. It's making sure you can get that right audience in front of you to keep you excited to keep coming back. And I think that's one of the areas of opportunity, I think, that exists on these platforms like that.
What's next for Captivate?
So, I mean, it's been an amazing year for us this year. And I think, you know, our team is continuing to grow significantly. And, you know, I think when we look at influencer marketing, really focused on just performance-driven influencer marketing. So all the data layers that are going to help make finding influencers a lot more effectively, and then attributing content and measurement, you know, more effectively. So, you know, we recently had a partnership announcement that we made with LiveRamp, the first influencer marketing company to partner with LiveRamp, that allows a brand to find influencers based on their existing customers. So, you know, that's an example of the type of data that we're trying to plug in at the start of the influencer marketing funnel in terms of finding influencers. And then if you go to the other side, it's just looking at different ways of looking at attribution. So, you know, we've integrated into a lot of the commerce platforms like Magento, Salesforce Commerce Cloud, Perfersion, et cetera. But we started moving upstream too, and, you know, integrating into platforms like AppsFlyer and Coachava and, you know, things of that sort that really allow you to see the end-to-end nature of influencer marketing and drive attribution and results back to the content that was created. So our goal is really to help you as a brand seamlessly launch, promote, and, you know, scale influencer programs that drive real business impact.
Speaking of Salesforce, let's get to our lightning round. Our lightning round, as always, is brought to you by our friends at Salesforce. You can go to salesforce.com/marketing to learn more about marketing on the world's number one CRM. That is Salesforce. Put your customer at the center of every interaction. We love Salesforce. They've been with us for 300 plus episodes because they're the best. They're the true, look at them, the true example of influencer marketing gone wonderfully right here, them sponsoring our show. Go to salesforce.com/marketing to learn more. Lightning round questions. Krishna, are you ready?
Let's do it.
You mentioned one of your favorite influencers. Do you have a second favorite influencer?
The Korean vegan. Vegan Korean, sorry.
Vegan Korean. That sounds great.
Yeah.
Well, what do they do?
You've got to check it out. So she talks about a lot of different topics impacting society. But while she's doing that, she is like, let's say social justice, things of that sort. She's also cooking at the same time. And so it's just super passionate, well-produced content. And it keeps you really engaged because you hear her voice while she's preparing a meal. It's awesome.
As someone who's built a career in marketing and advertising, what's one campaign that you're jealous of?
One of the first influencer campaigns was around Sonic. And you know, they essentially activated 10 different influencers. It was driving people to, you know, Sonic's drive-thru. But the way that they created that content on Instagram, the virality of it, just the authenticity of it, was just something that I was like, man, that is an amazing, you know, that is an amazing piece of content that was created.
What do you do for fun?
Road bike. Like to work out.
Do you have a favorite book, podcast, TV show, or something you've been checking out recently?
The All In Pod is pretty exciting.
Oh yeah, pretty wild. I had to stop listening. It gets me too fired up. They're so crazy.
Yeah.
Your best advice for a first time, either CMO, co-founder, or CEO.
I think when you look for a co-founder, one of the most important things to think about is just, you know, aligning on values. And I think a lot of time you don't think about values when you are looking at a co-founder, you're just looking at their skill set. But ultimately, if you have the same values, you could get through any of the challenges and ups and downs that you might have over the course of the next years building a company. And you know, that's something that I would definitely encourage people to look at early on.
Krishna, this has been absolutely awesome having you on the show. Thanks again for joining. For listeners, go check out Captive and the number 8.io, captivate.io, to learn more. Check out the marketplace, check out the platform. Awesome company, as you heard. Any final thoughts? Anything to plug?
Thank you so much for having me on here. I'm super excited. You know, Captivate, we're hiring across the board on, you know, sales and partnerships and products. So definitely check us out.
Awesome. Take care.
Thank you.